Scott Weinberg is a veteran film critic. Steven DeGennaro is a doctor of astrophysics. Listen in as these two nerds compare and contrast two noteworthy sci-fi films every week. They'll discuss the artistic quality of the films, whether they get the science right, and whether or not that even matters. Welcome to Science vs. Fiction.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of Science vs. Fiction, the very serious and important podcast about science in film. I am joined by my very impressive partner, Dr. Steven DeGennaro. Steven, how are you?
I am fine. Thank you for asking.
Already you sound defensive. This is going to be our most controversial episode ever. And I want to let our listeners know, before we get started, that no matter how venerated and how celebrated a film is, you will occasionally come across people that don't love it. And you have to accept it now. And if you're not willing to accept it, go back and listen to an episode like Star Wars, where we both love Star Wars. Because we're here to discuss two interesting films, Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049. Steven, why this pairing?
Well, so I think these two are the best of the Blade Runner movies, although, to be honest, I have not seen all of the 2048 of the movies that go in between, but...
The first 1,000 are really good. The first 1,000 or so are really good. After that, they kind of start repeating.
I mean, the good news is that, you know, even though it is the 2049th installment, it really feels very self-contained. I don't think you need all of that backstory. It's not like the Saw series where, like, you have no idea what's going on if you haven't seen all 55 Saw movies.
Shtick, ladies and gentlemen. We are committed to shtick. And today we are going to discuss first 1982's Blade Runner, directed by Ridley Scott, written by David Peoples, Hampton Fancher, based on the Philip K. Dick novel Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And it is I want to say, like, a lot of times when you call a film controversial, that means that, like, the subject matter is debated, hotly discussed, or whatever. But Blade Runner is controversial among sci-fi fans because everybody falls all over each other loving it. And,
except for everybody who saw it in the theater when it first came out.
Yeah, I don't think audiences or critics were really prepared for something like this in 1982. And I want to warn our listeners now, just so you have the scorecard ready, I absolutely adore the original Blade Runner. I think it's a masterpiece. And Steven, what's your thoughts?
I agree with most of the critics and audience that watched it in 1982. I don't hate it. We'll talk some more about what I do and don't like about it. But obviously the production design is fantastic and highly influential. But I think it's, for the most part, kind of talky and boring, and the dialogue is super on the nose, and everybody's motivations are opaque, and it's confusing, and unengaging. And so, like, I don't love this movie at all.
Oh, there you go, ladies and gentlemen, our final episode.
Hey, if I didn't lose everybody with my, you know, not loving the thing, then I don't think this is going to be the...
I don't know, man. Blade Runner is like the Casablanca of science fiction.
Except that everybody loved Casablanca when it came out. It was a massive hit. Like, this is the second
or third
movie.
Why does it matter
movie.
What people thought
it's
then?
It's not
Why
my
does
point.
That, that's not the context no, for but my to discuss. Why does that matter?
It matters because this is now the second, or I think maybe even the third movie that we've talked about on this podcast that was not well received when it first came out, and in the years since, people have reevaluated it, and good for them if they, you know, now look at that and go, okay, I like this movie a lot better than people did when it came out. That's a thing. It happens. It's happened to me for movies as well. But, like, for then those people to turn around and say, hey, you person who has the same reaction that all of the original people that saw this movie had before they reevaluated it must be wrong, and us people who have reevaluated it must be right. There's a certain amount of sort of arrogance involved in that, of like, okay.
No, well, I think it's more. I mean, that's a fair point, but I don't.
You just don't understand it. It's still too far ahead of your time.
No, not at all. I don't think that about you at all. I just think that. And we had an amiable argument about this the other day, and I want to bring it up for the show. And I don't think there's anything in Blade Runner that you missed or overlooked, and that's why you didn't understand it. You know, it's not what I think at all. But the idea that, okay, you're not really well-versed in classic film noir, All right, that you'll admit that. That's not a bad thing.
I am, and I'm not. I mean, I'm probably not as much as you, but I'm not like completely ignorant of it.
Right. Okay. Is there a situation if a person who watches Blade Runner and hasn't seen many film noir, which is the exact template of this movie, then they might appreciate the look and the sounds and the premise, but to really love the DNA, you kind of really need to know a bit about film noir. And I don't mean you. I just mean the viewer.
Well, I in thinking about this more over after we had that conversation, I realized that I think I'm generally speaking, just not a fan of noir. I was trying to think of all the sort of, you know, the classic noir, but also the neo-noir stuff that I've seen, stuff like Sin City and a lot of Coen Brothers, who I love the Coen Brothers, generally speaking, but when they move into that sort of noir mode, Blood Simple has never, ever done it for me. I don't understand, I don't get what people find so compelling about that movie. So it may just very well be that like, this is not my genre. Like, I don't.
Right.
I'm not a big fan of noir movies.
That's a great point. And, you know, even if you are like me, who I went on when I was younger, I never would have watched 40s and 50s, you know, crime thrillers and film noir and mystery. There's no interest. But right. Several years ago, I had a real interest and I rented through Netflix probably 45, 55 classic film noir in A Lonely Place, Where the Sidewalk Ends, stuff like that. And you start to really enjoy the bullet points of a film noir, which is a capable but hapless hero gets in over his head. There's a femme fatale. He starts to realize he's in a much bigger web of deceit than he thought. And, you know, the scales are taken from his eyes in some way. Yeah. And, you know, again, if you don't know or don't love film noir, that doesn't mean you have to love Blade Runner, but it is so evocative of that. And this was around a time when we were doing Body Heat and
which I don't care for.
A remake of Postman Always Rings Twice. So film noir and kind of neo-noir, like you said, were kind of popular or kind of resurgent in the early 80s. And I think this, to me, as somebody who now loves film noir, and I'll drop it after this, is just that this is the ultimate film noir, only shot 600 years into the future.
Yeah. You know, and you know, like The Hot Spot and Body Double and, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Chinatown even, like these are not movies that I love at
definitely
all.
Definitely Chinatown, definitely. Even Dark City, if you want to get into sci-fi noir, even Dark City.
Dark Skitter, we'll cover that at some point, and I'm going to, you know, I don't care for that movie either. So I guess it may just be that I don't like film noir, and that, you know, I think is perfectly acceptable. I will say this in regards to, you know, my third point about what you said, which is that a movie has to stand on its own. I mean, obviously every movie has influences and whatever else, but like a movie can't just be referencing things and have that be a stand-in for whether or not.
No, you are absolutely right. I would never say that, you know, oh, you can only enjoy Blade Runner if you're a half expert on film noir. I'm not. I'm just saying that I liked it and I admired the movie as a kid, but as I actually got into the tropes and the innate magic of film noir and rewatching this as an adult, it's just, I think it's exactly what they wanted to do. So anyway, the real quick synopsis, because I don't want to cut you off on this episode. I want to just get to the meat. To anybody who's not aware, Blade Runner is about a gumshoe detective who is tasked with tracking down a handful of replicants, aka robots.
They're not robots.
Well, they're very, very human-like.
They're not robots. They're biological.
They're cyborgs then.
No, they're not cyborgs. They have no electronic parts in them, at least according to any evidence in either of these movies. They are biological.
All right, I'll stick to the word replicant. Sorry.
Wow, it's an important distinction.
You're right.
And it will eventually, you know, there's a scientific aspect of that I want to talk about, but go on and continue.
Right. Well, a replicant is a superhuman, humanistic robot, one that you could barely tell the difference, and it takes our expert, he has trouble telling these replicants from human beings. And
Which if they were robots, if they had, you know, gears and circuits inside them, would be super easy.
Yeah, beep, boop, boop, right. And the real beautiful gist of the movie is, like, not just that these replicants, a.k.a. robots, are self-aware and want to extend their lives. What the jumping off point for this conflict, which I find fascinating, is that the company that makes them has now incorporated them with natural memories. The exotic memories. It used to be just like an algorithm, you know, a vague memory of being a child. But now they've started to give them exotic memories. And that is what is now making them then my interpretation is that humanity that they're ingested or injected with is what's making them so desperate to stay alive. Whereas if they didn't have that human touch or that human little edge inside them, they'd probably just work until they fell over and fall over.
See, that'd be it. Now it says that you say that, but that like textually doesn't jibe with what we actually learn on screen in the course of this movie.
Because, what are you talking about? Of course it is.
No, it doesn't, because the replicants that he is chasing are, again, I found this a lot of stuff in this movie very, very confusing, so it's possible that I'm completely wrong on this. But my understanding was that Rachel was the first of these replicants that have childhood memories, that she was an experiment by Tyrell to do this thing, which means that the replicants that are coming from this other planet and all the replicants that have rebelled in previous rebellions are replicants that didn't have childhood memories and whatever else. Am I wrong about that?
He says in one of the early meetings, we've implanted them with memories as like a new form of memory, like this is the new technology.
So my understanding when he meets Sean Young for the first time,
yeah,
is that the reason why she can fool him is because she has this thing and the other ones don't. Now, it's possible, like, so, you know, this gets at a little bit one of my issues with this movie sort of in general, and I guess probably film noir as a whole, which is that so much of the exposition is delivered via dialogue that it's super easy to miss key details like this because they are just part of a conversation that you don't realize is necessarily important.
I always, and I've seen the movie 7 or 8 times, I always took it as that's why this particular batch is self-aware and angry, because they have been given a taste of humanity that previous generations of replicant have not.
To me, the whole point of the movie is that he, over the course of this story, realizes that maybe these people the replicants have been people all along, and he's been killing them, and he's coming to realize that, you know, maybe all of the other replicants that he's killed over the course of his presumably long career as a Blade Runner are now, you know.
That is a great interpretation of it. There is also an interpretation that obviously says that Deckard, as played by Harrison Ford, is a replicant, and that adds a different wrinkle to the whole thing. I personally do not find that to be an interesting hook. Yeah. I think it's much more interesting if he is one of the last, capable humans on Earth.
Right.
And then the film, it follows a very, very film noir format, which is A to B to C. I got a clue here, then I go there, then I get a revelation here, then I meet a person there.
And there's a femme fatale.
Yep. And it does follow that noir template to a T. And I think what is so novel to a lot of movie fans is that it is a great structured film noir, and that you can kind of follow the plot. And yeah, it is a little bit confusing sometimes because a lot of film noir plots are kind of double back on each other and whatnot. But I think the reason that people like it a lot is because it is a fascinating film noir combined with a fascinating sci-fi film, and they're both there on the screen.
Yeah, and if you love both of those things, then absolutely, I can see why you would love this. You know, I found it simultaneously confusing in a lot of places because I was never entirely clear what the rules of the world were or what, you know, what a lot of the characters' motivations were. And I also found it, weirdly enough, despite being confusing, I also found it kind of predictable because it followed, like, we set up at the very beginning, okay, there's 4 replicants, his job is to kill all of them, and then he does. And, like, there's not really a whole lot of sort of twists and turns or, you know, to me, like, good film noir are ones where, like, 2 or 3 times throughout the movie, like, you know, The Spanish Prisoner, you know, a lot of David Mamet stuff where, like, suddenly everything that you thought you knew about who was a good guy and bad guy or who, you know, what was happening gets turned on its head by some revelation, you know, or some betrayal or whatever. And to me, like, this, it just played out in such a straightforward fashion that...
Yeah. That's a fair point. It almost seems like, is it leading to like a big conspiracy where the cops are in on it? And like a lot of times a film noir will say, oh, it's not just about 4 guys chasing each other with a knife. It's that this guy stumbled upon a conspiracy much, much larger. And in this, there's a lot of interesting kind of, you know, threads about him digging up info, but he never really uncovers like anything, a major scandal or conspiracy. It's just,
yeah,
a crime story.
Exactly. Think about like Chinatown in contrast, right? Yep. Exactly. Like you would never guess the ending of that movie, you know, at any point early on in the movie, because it does take so many sort of twists and turns, and he does uncover this much bigger conspiracy than he thought it was.
Yeah, you partially nailed why I like it so much, and it's that idea that, hey, you know, maybe everything we've been told throughout the movie isn't true at all. So the idea that maybe he's killing humans, but he's the one who is being lied to about their biology and their origin. And like, I've never even considered that, ever.
To me, like, that's the theme of it. I mean, it's a very Philip K. Dick kind of theme of, like, what makes a person a person? Like, is it, you know, just because you created this person in a lab and they only have a 4-year lifespan, does that give you a right to enslave them and brutalize them and then kill them when they're no longer of any use to you? And I think that, you know, especially in light of the sequel, which we'll talk about a bit more, takes those themes and deepens them considerably in the choices that it makes. But I think at its heart, yeah, absolutely, this is a movie about, like, what makes a person human, right? Because then the other aspect of this, the B story, is the story with Rachel, and she has been given all of these memories of, I guess, Tyrell's niece. And so she believes that she's a person at the beginning of the story. She has to come to terms with the fact that she is, in fact, a replicant, that none of her memories are real. And again, it's very, very Philip K. Dick in that regard.
He's brilliant. Can we just talk for a second about that? I know you've probably read more of him than I have, but Philip K. Dick, what a freaking genius. Where would you place him on the scale of sci-fi geniuses?
Oh, I don't know. Near the top.
Like with Asimov and Wells and Verne, like a back.
I mean, I find him more interesting because I think his thematic ambitions are a lot more interesting. They're a lot more human than a lot of the classic sci-fi masters are, which are, you know, kind of geeky and technological and like, oh, what if we had this technology?
Right. They have great concepts, but they don't always translate them to the human you know, equation.
Right. Whereas Philip K. Dick was obsessed with this idea of, like, what does it mean to remember something? What does it mean to be a person? Like, at what point does somebody become a person? I'm trying to think, you know, like Minority Report, fascinating idea of, like, do people have free will? If you can see what somebody's going to do before they do it, do they have a choice to not do it? He explored a lot of themes like that in his work, and that's one of the things that makes Philip K. Dick Philip K. Dick. And that's absolutely, I think, present in this movie, and one of its strong points for sure for me.
What I love about the movie is the nature of the replicant. And it's that question of, let's say you create an automaton. You create a human-sized robot to help you clean your house and wash your car. And it's just a machine. It's like a microwave oven.
Like a Roomba.
And then after a while, you realize, all right, well, I work with this machine every day. I'd like to make it, give it a little more personality. Give it a little more humanity. And then you keep doing that. You keep making it more advanced and more advanced. Does that make it more efficient or less as a machine?
It depends on what it is you want it for, but I would say, just, you know, largely for the kinds of things that we build machines to do, it makes it less efficient.
Right.
The only reason that you do that, right, you don't want your machines to have personality. You don't want them to—
Right, and that is one of the most interesting things about a lot of Philip K. Dick stuff is that the mistake was giving them memories. Now, why would you, if you are Tyrell, Stephen, what would be your logic for giving, like, making a robot more human? You make it more human, it's less willing to die. And that's the real crux of the movie. You know, if you kept it at 40% human, you might not have had all these conflicts. But you bumped it up to 80% human, and now they're fighting to stay alive.
Well, again, I have a different reading of the movie than you do on
good,
that point.
Go.
So, I'm just saying I don't think that that's supportable based on the events that happen in the thing. I think, again, I think that Rachel is the only person that he actually gave memories to. And why he did it was, I think, for largely personal reasons, and is because I don't think it's an accident that it's his dead niece whose memories he implanted into her. I think it is an attempt to sort of bring her back to life in a way.
So, okay, so what you're saying is the regular replicants, the Joanna Cassidy, Brian James, all those, they are the earlier model, and she is kind of the souped-up human memory model.
Yes.
Okay, that makes sense, because they do obviously are implanted with some kind of rudimentary memories, but she obviously seems special because maybe she was implanted not with generated memories, but
yeah,
human
memories. Yeah, I mean, it's not clear to me in this movie how much memories normal replicants are implanted with. Again, my impression from that scene where we first meet Rachel is that it is the, you know, that she is different. It takes him 100 questions or whatever in this Voight Kampff test to determine that she even is a replicant because she is so human, because she has these memories. Whereas with normal replicants, it's super easy to tell. You know, you can do it in 2 or 3 questions.
You know, I just randomly thought of this. You know, one thing I really love about this movie is that the five quote unquote villains, they're never together on the screen. Like Joanna Cassidy doesn't she doesn't deal with any of the other replicants. I just love the idea that you don't see all five of them land and they all walk across the screen together. No, they're scattered around the city, you know?
So it wasn't clear to me how long ago this thing happened. Presumably it must have been relatively recently because like they call in Harrison Ford and they're like, you gotta go search for these replicants. It's implied at least that they got there recently.
Yeah.
Right? Because we see in the opening scene that one of them kills the person administering the test. And so, like, it's days at most that they have been down here on Earth, or nights in the case of this movie.
Right. You got to assume that that's like customs or something, right?
Right. And so it was very confusing to me how that other, you know, how the woman found a job as a snake stripper, and or why she found a job as a snake stripper if she'd only been there for like 24 hours.
To me, I mean, again, I'm not making excuses for a hole or anything, but I always just thought the plan was we committed a crime, scatter.
Yeah, but they didn't scatter. They all came to the same city and they stayed in the same city.
Right.
My impression was that the plan was we got to find Tyrell so that he can, or we got to find, you know, the people that created us so that they can extend our lives. That was what I assumed that the plan was, but I don't understand how her being a stripper fit into that plan. Like, I don't, that didn't make any sense to me. And it still doesn't.
Fair point. You know, just trying to fit in, make some money, yeah. I guess, you know.
Yeah, but like 24 hours later and she's already got a job. I don't know.
It's a fair point. And there's a lot of things in this movie, intentionally or otherwise, that are just not filled in. And maybe they thought that they weren't important. And as a viewer, you're like, well, most of them maybe not. But A and B are kind of important. you know?
Well, I mean, I think that's probably why they added the voiceover to the original theatrical version, is because I think audiences were confused about what was going on in it to a point where – and maybe, you know, if you watch the movie a couple dozen times because you really, really love the small scale of it, like you start to figure all of these things out for yourselves. And, you know, there's something to be said for movies that do that. And I certainly like plenty of movies that raise more questions on first viewing than answers. But for me, like, I spent most of the movie just kind of confused. And obviously I'm not an intelligent person. So I don't know.
I mean, but, you know, again, if you were confused, then that's a bad thing, clearly. But that is also kind of one of the components of the film noir structure, which is it gets circuitous. It gets labyrinthine. They start piling up on each other. But then another person could say, hey, I paid close attention. And if I'm halfway lost, that's not on me.
Well, Craig Mazin likes to talk a lot about on Script Notes about the line between confusion and mystery.
Right.
And to me, this movie was just way over the line on the confusion side. I think film noir obviously works best when there's a mystery and you're like, I don't understand what's happening, but I get that the characters understand what's happening. And again, when we start talking about the sequel, which I feel does all of these things right in a way that the original doesn't, I can be a lot more explicit about exactly the kind of things I'm talking about. But in context of sort of the scientific elements of this, it definitely raised a lot of questions for me that I was confused about in a way that I don't understand some of what the scientific things are in here. So probably the biggest one for me, these replicants are genetically engineered people, and they are they're created with a 4-year lifespan and super strength and, you know, various other qualities that make them useful as slaves. And yet the only way to tell them apart from regular people, or, you know, natural-born people, I guess you could call them, is with this complicated psychological test that requires them to sit still and look their eye into this thing and measures involuntary responses to emotional stimuli, something like that.
Right. Basically a real, real fancy lie detector test.
Essentially, right. And, so I got to thinking about it. I was like, well, you know, there must be something in their genes that makes them only live for 4 years and gives them super strength and whatever else. So it seems logical that a genetic test would be super easy to administer and tell a replicant from a non-replicant. And then it occurred to me that, you know, when this story was written and when the movie was made in 1982, the idea of just like getting a blood sample from somebody and running it and seeing what their genes
right.
are was so far into the future that they just probably didn't even think about that as a thing that you could do, you know? And so
a very good point.
That was a thing that while I was watching the movie bothered me a little bit, but thinking about it more a bit later on, I realized that at least, you know, in the context of if you watch this in 1982, it would seem a lot less like a plot hole than it does for somebody in 2020.
That's part of the beauty of this movie, I think, is that, like, obviously you can appreciate it. It doesn't hit you on a personal level. You don't love it. But we can roll this stuff around in our heads and just debate this all day. And that's the beauty of Philip K. Dick stuff, is that do Pris and Roy Batty, and do they have – what is it that inspired this group to do this? You know, obviously there have been fights, and it mentions in The Crawl that there have been other battles, but what makes them come back to Earth as a group, per se, and try to look up their maker and demand more life? That,
I mean, that, you know, in a sense, is a very human thing, obviously, yep, right there. Yep. Like, to want to meet your maker, to want to extend your life, means that you have some sense of your past. And that, you know, and again, I think that this is one of the reasons why they didn't implant memories into replicants before now, is because the reason why they gave them the 4-year lifespan is because that's about how long it takes for a human being to sort of develop the kind of empathetic qualities that make them human. And at that point, the replicants would realize, hey, we're not supposed to be slaves anymore and we need to, you know, revolt. And so—
Right. And it just brings up this fascinating hook of, if you allow a robot or an android or something created in a lab to feel slightly human, then you have to treat it like a human. You right. can't, you know what I mean? If a robot knows what it means to live and die, then killing it is cruel.
Yeah.
Like, period. It's not like killing a toaster. A toaster is not self-aware, but yeah. these replicants clearly are. And if you create something, doesn't matter how artificial it is, if you create yeah. something artificial and tell it you are alive and you will not be alive in 4 years, that entity is going to be terrified and probably angry.
Yeah.
And to me, that is such the beauty of this movie, of this story, is, you know, where exactly does humanity lie? Where?
Yeah.
In the heart, in the brain, in the soul. You know, at the end of the yeah. movie, spoiler, the ostensible monster shows mercy to the guy who's trying to kill him. Roy Batty is upset because he desperately wants to live longer and feel human for longer.
Yeah.
And he feels empathy for Harrison Ford ultimately because he is human and terrified to die. It, to me, it's really beautiful.
My wife pointed out when we were watching it, the other aspect of that scene, which I hadn't thought about, which is that it feels like what he's really trying to do throughout a lot of that last cat and mouse scene is die on his own terms.
Yeah.
You know, he knows he's going to die. He's at the end of his 4-year lifespan. He's kind of going a little bit crazy, which is implied but never quite stated. And, you know, Harrison Ford is trying to kill him. And he finally gets to the point where he's like, okay, they have the fight on the roof. And he wants to hang on to every moment of life that he has until he can't anymore. And again, that's a very sort of deeply human thing. My issue, and I don't want to, like, it's not about bad-mouthing the movie, but the reason why I think a lot of this doesn't work for me is that I felt like a lot of that humanity was missing from the movie in a way. Like, it was hard for me to feel connected to any of the characters.
Fair, totally fair.
I love Harrison Ford as an actor, obviously, and he has played at least two of the most iconic roles in the history of cinema. And, you know, when you call on him to do the things that he's good at, which is sort of wisecracking, you know, scoundrelly kind of people, obviously he's brilliant. I think in this movie, he feels just like a blank slate, you know? I don't get any sense of what his character is. I don't ever get any sense, why did he become a Blade Runner? Why is he killing people? Why did he retire from killing people? Why does he decide to unretire? Because this guy just asks him to.
All of those questions could be answered with the, maybe he is a replicant. All of those questions, because they want that gray area. We don't have a lot of backstory about Deckard, because yeah. they want us to think he might be one of them, and they've only pulled him out of the closet to dust him off to go send him after these robots or replicants. Yeah. I keep saying robots, yeah. But no, it's. But you know, you're certainly not wrong, and I'm not refuting your opinion. But I think what you're responding to, that it lacks a human element, and it does. A lot of this movie is very clinical and icy cold, and I think yeah. it's fascinating in that way. But for a lot of people, if you don't have any sort of human rooting interest, it just starts to feel like kind of like a video game.
Yeah.
But to me, thematically, what's so important is we see very little humanity in the movie. And then ironically, at the end, it's from the alleged monster that yeah. we really see some humanity.
Well, so let's he's not an alleged monster. We watch him murder several people on screen.
Yeah.
He's a monster.
Okay, yes.
We can argue yeah. about whether or not, you know, we made him a monster, but like there's no doubt that he's not a good person.
Right. Is Frankenstein's monster a monster? I mean, is it the monster's fault?
It's right there in his name.
It's not Roy's fault
yeah.
that he is made fractured.
Yep.
He is, you know, that's, it's in yep. his wiring.
Well, so a couple of other points of confusion that I was a little confused about that are touch on the scientific sort of thing. It felt like the replicants had, that their all of their eyes glowed at various points in the movie.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure whether or not that was supposed to be a filmic touch or whether this is actually supposed to be happening in world, because it seems like that's a better way to figure out who's a replicant.
Yeah, I kind of thought that was a cheat for the audience. Kind of like, just to remind you, you know, this is the android, and if the light hits him in a certain way, you can see it. But
like, again, like all he would need is a flashlight to determine that, okay, yep, here's a flashlight, you're a replicant. Yep.
Why do you need a snake if you're going to be a stripper? Why? I mean, that's an expensive artificial snake. Why? Yeah. Why?
Well, there were also, you know, occasions where characters made decisions that I just didn't understand. Like, there, you know, Daryl Hannah is fighting him towards the climax of the movie, and she has him in a vice grip in between her thighs. She's choking the life out of him. And then she just lets him go, backs up, and then does gymnastics at him, which allows him to shoot her. And I didn't understand why she didn't just kill him.
All right. Well, I mean, I never really thought of that, but if I had to off the top of my head, Pris is a pleasure model and not really geared for being super intelligent. She is, however, geared for being very limber and acrobatic. So, you know, just a simple, I mean, it's a fair question. It is. If they were that threatened by Deckard, she would just crush him between her thighs and be done with him.
And then Roy Batty, a couple minutes later, you know, plays, like literally plays hide and seek with him instead of just killing him.
I think the Batty thing is that he wants him to feel the fear. He wants Deckard to feel that fear that he feels every minute, knowing that he could just break down and die right at any moment.
That makes some sense.
And he doesn't want to just kill him. He wants to scare him.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I can buy that. Again, that doesn't feel like something that I picked up on. And I don't know if that's my fault or the movie's fault.
He says, "What, don't you want to know what it's like to live in fear?"
Yeah.
But if the movie lacks a human element, it's almost like saying a joke lacks any humor until the punchline.
Well, yeah.
That's what this movie is. It's like trying to like find the humanity in this like ugly remnant of Earth.
Yeah.
Flying cars, Stephen. How realistic is it that we could have flying cars?
I mean, I hate to quote him, but there's a really interesting video clip of Neil deGrasse Tyson talking about flying cars. And he points out that we basically do, and they're called helicopters. That, you know, for a car to fly would require some sort of propulsive force lifting it up into the air, which would involve...
Or pushing it off the ground.
Yeah, but if you push it off, in order for it to stay in the air, it has to basically be forcing a massive amount of air downward.
Right, and it looks like the flying cars in this movie are just have, like, propulsion that just points at the ground and pushes them up.
Yeah, and that would generate a massive amount of wind.
Right, okay.
It would be like standing underneath a helicopter every time you were near one of those things. And, you know, to his credit, this movie kind of looks like it does that a little bit. I mean, I can buy them, and largely because of that, because of the fact that we can see, we can get a sense of how this thing is holding itself up. It's not some weird, you know, anti-gravity technology that's completely beyond our scientific understanding, even now in 2020, let alone in 2019 when this movie takes place.
You know what's fascinating, though, and I'm just thinking about it now, is that we don't see all that much traffic. And it leads me to that issue of, and we talked about this earlier, the world is now half empty. It seems like everybody who is either young or beautiful or wealthy or super strong is gone. And what's left on Earth are...
the dregs.
Like, yeah, I don't want to be cruel about it, but yeah, it seems like people who couldn't afford it, people who are sickly, people who are old, what the elite would consider undesirable.
So, yeah, I mean, I didn't pick up on that at all. Like, I just assumed that that was the sort of underworld that he was... you know, that's where these replicants would go because that's where they would be most blend in. I didn't get the impression that, like, the entire Earth was like that. I just thought that, like, okay, well, they're in Chinatown in whatever city this is. Is it San Francisco?
Yeah, they keep talking about off-world, off-world, and you're like, oh, okay, so, like, all the really successful people are up on Venus.
Oh, see, I thought that the off-world, you know, especially because they're talking about super strong slave labor, I assumed that the off-world stuff were all, you know, like mining colony type things that were bringing resources back to the Earth.
Right, but that much slave labor is serving who? It's certainly not serving the people of Los Angeles.
Well, again, it's not serving the subset of the people of Los Angeles that he goes through.
Yeah, good point. You're right. This movie could take place in a 5-mile radius, and there could be a beautiful, gleaming LA somewhere else. That
I also was very confused about the fact that, like, I you know, obviously the word noir means black, dark.
Yeah.
And so I understand the creative choice to do this, but it definitely, like, more than once in this movie, I thought, okay, does he just sleep all day and then wake up and go blade running at night? And if so, why? Like, what's the in-world explanation for the fact that we literally never see the sun until the end of the movie?
Again, that, you know, we barely see any humanity until the end of the movie. And I think that's part of the point is that.
Well, yeah, no, again, like I said, I understand the thematic decision and the creative decision to do that. I couldn't help but think, like.
Oh, what about the rain? What does the constant rain imply to you?
That it's in a rainy place? I don't, you know.
Well, that, I mean, that the climate is, you know, askew. You know?
I see, but again, that to me, like, that's so much a part. Like, I wouldn't think that if I were watching a true noir movie.
No, because it's not take doesn't take place in the ostensible future. But I mean, like, by the fourth exterior where it's raining, you're like, okay, it literally always rains. Got
yeah, but again, I feel like it literally always rains in every noir movie, regardless of whether it's in the future.
Yeah,
so, like,
true,
that's
true,
just a
true.
Convention as much as it is telling us anything about the story.
That's a fair point. That is. I just kind of love the.
Yeah, no, there's the other aspect of that is the. The Asian influence of everything, you know, is he yeah. just in sort of the Chinatown area, or like has Los Angeles become completely Asianified, for lack of a better word?
Or right. the world. Has the world become a lot more right. connected, just like in our beloved Firefly Serenity kind of thing, you know?
And
like,
I don't think the movie answers that question because
it doesn't have to.
See,
it's just.
No, I'm not saying it has to. I'm just saying, like, I don't think that it. I don't think you could tell just from the movie whether or not this just happens to take place in this small area that is like this, or whether the entire world is like that. I think that the sequel goes to some wider environments, you know, probably because it could afford to, and so we get a better sense of what the whole world is like as opposed to just this one sub part of the world.
Science, can you talk about? Sebastian is my favorite character. He is a strange man who lives alone, and he designs these replicants for Tyrell, and he also is clearly very talented, and he creates a bunch of human-sized toys for himself. And this sequence used to give me nightmares when I was a kid. This sequence is creepy, but also kind of sad and beautiful.
Yeah.
Obviously, the movie is intentionally sketchy about the actual science, but if you cut open a replicant, is it, can we just say a clone?
I modified a genetically modified clone.
Right. Okay.
Which actually brings up another point that I was thinking about scientifically as well, which is I guess that there are, you know, they have different models of replicants that are built for different things. Pris's a pleasure model.
Right. They say Leon can carry blah, blah, 200 pounds. And
but my question is, I can see why each of the models looks different from one another. But why aren't, like, all of the, you know, strong models built like Leon and all of the pleasure models built like – like, why do they have them – obviously, they have different faces because they don't just say, hey, it's a replicant. You know what replicants look like because there's only six models and you know what each of them looks like. So, like, why do they make replicants that have different – facial features? Like, why would they not make them all look the same? So that way you one of them shows up
question.
In Los Angeles, you're like, hey, that's a replicant because I know that because all the replicants look like that guy.
One of the themes in Dick's material is the hubris of man. It's not just our intelligence, it's our arrogance.
Right.
And you would start to think, well, gee, if you were going to create replicants that were strong and intelligent and possibly capable of being self-aware, why wouldn't you create, like, a big red light in their forehead?
Like a safeguard of some sort.
Yeah, so that everywhere you go, you'd be like, human. Oh, replicant. Big red, big red bicycle light in the forehead.
Or give him green skin because it's not like they need, you know.
A giant antenna coming out of the forehead. Just something.
Right. In the sequel, they finally figured that out by the 2049 in the sequel. And they all have tattoos, serial numbers in their eyeballs so that you can, you know, so that's a way to identify them in the future. It is sort of weird that they didn't consider that, especially after the first, you know, this is the sixth generation. It's the Nexus 6.
Right. And another fair question would be, hey, we live in a movie universe that puts self-destruct buttons in spaceships, which makes no sense. Why wouldn't you have replicants that you could push a button and, you know, six of them drop dead?
And they would just die. Yeah.
But despite, I love the idea that this isn't a movie that answers all these questions. It has some really cool questions and it has some really cool answers. Yep. And the rest of it is discuss amongst yourselves, you know?
All right. So I think you've done a good job of summarizing exactly why you love this movie. So I'll just say, just give me a letter. What's your grade?
The final cut. And we're going to have a special guest at the end of this episode to break down the differences between the various versions. But the final cut is, to me, one of the best science fiction films I've ever seen. It's an A+. It's a brilliant film noir. I get that it lacks humanity. I get that it gets a little contorted and raises some questions that it never answers. And it's imperfect in many ways. I could watch it twice a year. I it's a hard movie to, like, love. Like, you love The Princess Bride. But I admire it so much, you know? I just think it's fascinating. And I do love it. It's just not kind of a warm love.
it's a C for me. I think that the production design is spectacular. I think the cinematography is fantastic. I think that it builds a world, visually builds a world that is fascinating and interesting and feels very real. Like at no point, even though this movie is now 30 years old, 40 years old, there are almost no effects in it that don't work. Even today, you know, like there's almost nothing in there that took me out of the movie. Like you can tell in, you know, in some places that, okay, that's clearly a miniature, but not in a bad way. Like not in a way that, you know, a lot of movies from this era, I mean, you know, one we just talked about last week, Flash Gordon, you know, which was only 2 years earlier and had markedly worse special effects.
Anyway.
but yeah, no, it doesn't, I don't know. It just, it, like, I don't feel like the movie has any soul. And I think that I find it confusing and talky, and I wish that it were more like the movie that we're going to cover next, which is Blade Runner 2049.
All right, and as far as I mean, again, a lot of this is really smart hand wavy science, but on a general scale, what would you give Blade Runner for scientific intelligence?
I don't know, B.
Okay.
I think that it misses a couple of key things about replicants and how genetics works, but it can be forgiven for that, given when it was created. I don't really buy this Voight-Kampff test scientifically, even though I totally understand why it's there thematically.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating scene where Brian James, the late Brian James, who plays Leon, is being interviewed. And you'd be like, okay, so it's basically a morality test.
Yeah.
Okay, would you turn over a hot turtle in the sand? Yes or no? Right. You know, like.
but it's not his answers that matter. His answer, you know, what he says is not what's important. It's what his body's physiological reactions, you know, his automatic physiological reactions that he can't control are what's important. So like you said, it is kind of like a lie detector test, which aren't scientifically valid for the most part. So
no, they're not. You're right. Let's just move on, Stephen, because I know you like Blade Runner 2049 a lot more, and I don't want people trashing you because you were honest about a classic that you don't love. So let's move on to a movie I know you freaking love, Denis Villeneuve's Blade Runner 2049.
Yeah.
Now, you love this movie.
I mean, it is one of the best movies of the last 10 years.
I like it very much. I think you and I think I like Blade Runner, let's just call it 2 to save the syllables. I think I like Blade Runner 2 considerably more than you like Blade Runner, but I still like Blade Runner more. So yeah. I am going to cede to you on plot synopsis and effusive praise. Go.
All right. So plot synopsis is in some ways as simple as the original, but also as, you know, a lot of layers of complexity thematically that I love. The gist of it is that, you know, now instead of Harrison Ford, we have Ryan Gosling, who plays a Blade Runner, and plot twist, he actually is a replicant, that this is now 30 years in the future from the original, and we have solved the sort of replicants running away problem somehow. It's, you know, it tells us this in the opening text. We don't really know how it happens. And he is running blades one day and kills David Bautista, who is an escaped Blade Runner from an off-world colony. And he discovers in David Bautista's garden the skeleton of what appears to be a replicant who has birthed a live child.
Dun, and this, dun, dun.
Yeah, this would obviously mean profound things for the social order of the world of Blade Runner. And so his boss, who is a human, played by Robin Wright, is desperate to keep it a secret. And so she sends him to go and hunt down this child and retire them so that they can save the world. And over the course of the story, he starts to believe that maybe it might be him, that he might be the child, that, you know, he has some memories that fit memories that this child would have. He is born around the right time, and so he starts to believe that it's actually him.
Right, and the audience, this is one of the cleverest parts of the movie, the audience starts to be like, oh, I get it, Ryan Gosling is Harrison Ford's long-lost son, I'm down, I get it, I'm cool with that. And then they pull the rug out and make it another interesting twist.
Yeah, and, you know, and that felt so obvious to me on some level that I was like, okay, well, clearly it can't be Ryan Gosling, so now who else do we think it could possibly be? And they have another clever bit of misdirection, because his main antagonist throughout this movie is another replicant who is owned by Jared Leto, who is sort of the successor to Tyrell, who's the mad genius who is now creating replicants and trying to create replicants that, specifically trying to create replicants that can reproduce.
Essentially, he's come up against a technological wall, and the next breakthrough he's looking for is, can they procreate? And right. that also comes to the issue of, if these are just genetically modified clones, obviously they've been genetically modified so they cannot have babies. Is the implication that life will find a way, Jurassic Park style?
No, I feel like it has to be the opposite, right? Because it means that they have to have been created. They can't just be clones. Because if they were clones, then all you would do is you would knock out whatever genes are required in order to reproduce, and fixing that would be easy. You would just not do that. And so the fact that it takes him generations and he fails over and over again to try to create a replicant that can reproduce implies that these things are being created from scratch or something somehow. Because if they were just people who didn't have the genes to reproduce, then you would just give them back the genes to reproduce. And clearly that's not an option for him.
Right, right. So the movie in Blade Runner, we could have maybe assumed that they were clones that were slightly genetically modified to make them stronger and lifespan shorter.
Right.
But this movie advances the theory that no, there's obviously some sort of human cloning or DNA cloning involved, but it's also more a technological.
Well, and that also fits in a little bit with the Sebastian character and the creatures that he has running around his place that are, have human qualities, but clearly aren't human, that are clearly built from a melange of, they aren't just clones of something.
Yeah, so you could get the idea that Sebastian brought some like spare parts home from work for 2 years.
And
built those toy people.
Right.
But we're done with Blade Runner. We're sticking out.
No, but I'm saying what I was saying was that Jared Leto's character has this female henchwoman,
is love.
Yeah. Who's fantastic.
She's great. She's one of the most interesting characters in the movie.
I feel like visually the movie tries to push the idea.
She's the Roy Batty. That's why. I mean,
well,
she's
But if you look at her and you look at her haircut and like the actor that they chose and the way that they chose to present her.
Very Rachel-y.
I felt was very clearly meant, exactly, was meant to evoke Sean Young in the original.
Yep.
So that you would then think, so that if you were like not fooled by this thing of Ryan Gosling being the kid, you would immediately go to, okay, well, it must be her. And then it turns out, of course, to not be her either, which was a second mystery.
Oh, but you know what? I thought you were going to go another direction. I think you're absolutely right, but I think what's more interesting is that Rachel has become sort of like a prototype for a certain of the female replicant. Like they've been mass producing the female replicants that evoke or look like Rachel for years and years because she is patient zero or whatever. So she doesn't look exactly like her, but her lipstick and her hairstyle and her clothes, she's
clearly
Rachel-ish.
Yeah. I mean, there's not an accident that she looks a lot like Sean Young in the original for sure. A couple of things one of the things that I wrote down at the very beginning this time watching it through was if Bautista is a Nexus 6, which I think it establishes that he is, presumably he still has that 4-year time limit, but that can't be right because it later on establishes that he was there when.
Yeah, no, you're right. His model must come after the Roy Batty models because they will all have the 4-year span.
He's got to be at least 20 years old because he was there when this child was born. And he's the one who buried the body after she died in childbirth. So clearly he can't, either he figured out a way to get past the 4-year lifespan or he was not. But I thought I remembered them saying specifically he was a Nexus 6, but I don't know.
Now, let me ask you this, Steven. Is the hook of this movie, which is can replicants procreate with humans, right? Is that the hook?
It's a hook. I think that one of the things I love about this movie, like I said earlier, is that it deepens this thematic idea of like what makes a person, and it does it in several ways. It's obviously it has this idea of like if somebody is born of a replicant, then they are in some sense even more human than a replicant is. It has the idea of Kay, the character Kay, played by Ryan Gosling, who is himself a replicant but has very many human qualities that they try to sort of tamp down. And at one point he basically gets fired from the Blade Runner Corps and told that he's going to be killed if he can't get his shit under control. And so you have him representing this extra level of sort of like, well, he's even more human now than like the Roy Batty character because he has memories and he supposedly grew up, or at least he thinks that he did. So he's more equivalent to the Rachel character in the first movie. And then you have this other subplot where he has a, for lack of a better word, a digital girlfriend.
I could watch, you know what, forget the whole mystery, forget Deckard, forget the rest of the plot. I could just watch the two of them for 2 hours.
Well, it's a fascinating, fascinating idea.
I know. And they're like, she's a hologram, he's a replicant. Neither of them are human, but yet, obviously, they're both created by humans.
Right.
And like, so you're not just like, well, I don't care because they're two non-humans, so who cares?
Right.
But they're artificial creatures trying to find some humanity in themselves. It's
and they clearly have, they clearly have will. But then, you know, there's this ball of wax that it opens up with, you know, when talking about the feminist stuff, like,
oh yeah,
he has this digital girlfriend who was, you know, we see her, you know, not her, but we see like her model on billboards as this sex pot thing that they're selling to people, you know, like, here, you get to have all the benefits of a girlfriend. You know, but she waits on you hand and foot.
She's called Joy with an I, and ostensibly how it works is she's a hologram, but then if you're like loaded, you can get this machine called an emulator that makes her three-dimensional model in a limited range. And then, you know, I like how they keep introducing new technology to allow Joy to have more of a life, because she is, despite being a hologram, the most vibrant and lovable of all the characters in the film.
Yeah, and it's a very thorny question of, like, if she was built to serve him, is that all that he is responding to, or does she have free will? Does she have the ability to choose whether or not to love him? Because and there's a lot of this is in the writing, the subtlety of the writing, and in the performances of both of these characters and their interactions with one another and the chemistry that they have.
She's clearly made to be a sex toy, and this replicant loves her. He doesn't look at it like that's a device I can use for sexual needs. He loves this entity. He loves her. And that is interesting.
But at the same time, she is introduced to us serving him dinner. And so it's very thorny. And I think there are some feminist critics that didn't appreciate the movie for that. And there are other feminist critics who are like, no, that's the point. It's commenting on the way that women are treated in our world.
And the way that if we, you know, extrapolate the way that women are objectified in society now, imagine what it would look like in 50 years where, a giant holographic billboard of a half-naked woman. Yeah, okay. I mean, it's shocking in the film, but is it that unrealistic?
I mean, I don't think it's an accident that her name is Joy with an I. And, you know, I won't tell people to Google that if they don't know what it means, because at least don't do it at work.
What about the fact that the most violent and intimidating replicant is called Love?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's her name. Joy and Love are the two women that he's, you know, and they're not even women. They're female creations.
Yeah. There's this amazing scene where Mackenzie Davis, who plays a prostitute.
Kind of, I would say, the next-gen Pris, right?
Well, it's not clear. It's not 100% clear whether she is a replicant or not.
She looks a little bit. She evokes Pris a little bit, and it just seems like—
It's implied, I think, during the first conversation he has with her that she is a replicant, but she doesn't confirm it, and so she's a little coy about it, which I think was sort of interesting. But no, this scene, which is sizzling, honestly, and fantastic— because of the chemistry between like all three of these people, Joy hires her to come in and basically be her body so that she can project herself over Mackenzie Davis's body and Ryan Gosling can touch her and feel her and make love to her and feel like he's with Joy, who obviously does not otherwise have a corporeal presence in the world. And again, it's like the questions that raises philosophically are, I find, fascinating.
And what really interests me is you're looking at a scene with two replicants and an intelligent hologram. And in a lot of films, you'd be like, I don't care. This is a robot making out with light. I don't care.
No, it's a robot making out with another robot who's being clothed.
Right, who is projected with 3D light. And you'd be like, you know, it's almost like Transformers. Oh, look, that giant piece of CGI is bashing another giant piece of CGI.
Right.
One is supposed to be good, one is supposed to be bad, but I don't really care.
Right.
And yet in this movie, You have three interesting characters who are 0% human.
Right.
Or maybe not zero, but very little human.
Right.
And it's touching and sexy and sad and funny.
Yeah.
And that's part of what makes this movie so unique is that you care about the artificial intelligence. Your brain doesn't just go, that's a machine. I don't care.
Yeah. And to me, a lot of that comes down to, this is what I was saying earlier, where obviously I respect the hell out of Harrison Ford as an actor. I feel like he was miscast in the original Blade Runner. And I think Ryan Gosling sort of proves the point for me, because Ryan Gosling, you can tell like so much of what is going on behind his eyes. You know, like you can feel the humanity in him, even though in some ways he is just as icy cold as, you know, the original Blade Runner movie. You know, he doesn't smile a lot. He doesn't do anything that sort of outwardly. He gets a little upset in places, but he.
Oh, he just flips out a couple times,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, but he has so much presence to him. And look, he has so much chemistry with Anna.
I think I can nail the issue here, and I think you'll agree with me. I adore Harrison Ford. He is a matinee idol. He's funny. He's grouchy. He's likable. Young, old, just love. I love Harrison Ford. Nobody in the universe, probably including him, would call him ultra versatile.
No.
Right? He is good at a handful of things, and he's damn good at them. Ryan Gosling is a lot more like spectrum, a whole spectrum of emotion.
He's a chameleon.
And there are a few moments, there's a bit where he learns some information halfway through the movie and he's quiet for like 10 seconds and then he flips out and kicks a chair. And I'm thinking, no disrespect, but that's what I need a little bit of that from Harrison Ford in the first movie. Yeah.
Well, so to me, the irony of it is that, you know, so to continue with the plot, he eventually decides to track down Harrison Ford so that he can get the story of how this replicant was born, and tracks down Harrison Ford in Las Vegas, which has been completely emptied by a dirty bomb at some point in the past, and it's gorgeous cinematography.
Yeah, we have essentially three locations in the movie. L.A., which is like Blade Runner 1, but much more advanced and foggy and ugly. Yeah. We have San Diego, which is essentially a giant trash pit. And we have Las Vegas, which, as Steven mentioned, is an irradiated wasteland, and Deckard lives, I believe, it's inside of an abandoned casino with a dog.
Yeah, and so Harrison Ford's performance in this movie, in the brief part that he's in, which is almost barely more than a cameo, I think he does better work throughout than he did in the entire first movie.
Oh, all right. Well, you know what, man? I'll give you that one more point about Harrison Ford, and this is just my opinion. As much as I love the guy, he didn't become a damn good actor until, like, Witness, and that was 85. And this is 82. And, you know, here he's playing kind of a one note. And I think the direction he was given is maybe he's a moody human. Maybe he's a reluctant replicant. We're not going to say. So you have to play it real mellow, real reserved. And that's the balance that he struck. Not only has Harrison Ford become a much, much better actor in the last 30 years, but I think now he knows this character. Now he knows what Deckard is. That's all.
And to be completely frank, I think it's better writing too. I think that the writing is better. One of the things about film noir that we haven't talked about yet is the sort of hard-boiled dialogue aspect of it, which actually makes me think of one of the few neo-noir movies that I actually adore, which is Brick, because the dialogue is so
very good.
Freaking fantastic.
Stylized and unique, yeah.
I don't feel like the dialogue scintillated in Blade Runner. You know, to me, it never rose to that level that the best noirs are capable of.
I think a lot of times it could just be, you know how like somebody will love a cover of a classic song and you'll be like, well, why wouldn't you just listen to the original? Well, the cover speaks to that person. That cover came out when that person was, 15, and they might respect and admire the original, but the second version of the song is what was in their heart, for their generation. And I know a lot of people love 2049, and I think it's because that's your grandfather's or your father's Blade Runner. And those scientific questions were asked in the early 80s. This is much more advanced in the questions that it's asking.
Yeah, and I find it better pretty much across the board. And even the things that I liked about Blade Runner, the original, I think are better in this one. I think obviously the cinematography and the production design in the original are fantastic and highly influential. I think the cinematography in 2049 is among the best cinematography ever done. Like,
it's stunning. It's stunning.
Like, from beginning to end, like, there's no part of this movie that isn't amazing.
Yeah, and he does. I'm going to speak for you. He doesn't mean just the showy bits where we see a landscape or a cityscape. He means just scenes where people are sitting and talking.
No, again, I think you could print out any frame of this movie and hang it on your wall, and you'd have an amazing looking painting.
Roger Deakins, beautiful.
Yeah. Well, Roger Deakins, right? Cinematography and also and the production design and Denis Villeneuve's
we'll get it
direction. I think all of those work in concert. I think without Villeneuve's direction, like none of the rest of this stuff really.
His visual style. His visual style.
The visuals
are, right. You know, like there's lots of people out there who can make a good sci-fi movie, but you need somebody who is willing to not only borrow paint from a 30-year-old palette, but also have their own colors ready to go.
Right. And he improve did. Upon it in almost every way. Like this, the cinematography and production design in this is beyond spectacular. And watching this on a big screen was just one of the most like coolest experiences I've had in the theater. None of which would matter if I didn't also feel invested in the characters. And I felt instantly invested in Ryan Gosling and only got more invested in him as the story went on because of the subtlety of the humanity that he portrays in this performance, even though he is ostensibly not a human.
But that's part of what makes this screenplay so smart is that Denis knows that, look, we've already established that. People already know what the rules of the replicants are, and now I'm going to lay down another layer of rules beneath it.
Exactly. And, you know, the way that it extends, you know, so after he gets back from Vegas, he gets hooked up with a group of replicant freedom fighters who, you know, want to free replicants from their bondage. And it is just sort of taken as a given that they deserve that. Whereas, you know, that was the central dramatic question of the first movie is like, are replicants people? Do they deserve the things that people have?
Oh, yeah. No, that's not that. That is a great theme that's not lost on me. And it's just like when you talk about civil rights, it's like 50 years ago, it was, do these people deserve rights? And hopefully nowadays it's like, yeah, that's the obvious answer. The question now is, how do we ensure that everybody has equal rights? That's
right.
like the old movie asked, do replicants have the right to do this or the ability to do that? And this movie has said, yeah, they do. The question is, how do we handle that?
Like, right. And also now we extend that to, well, does that mean that Joy has rights? Because one of the most like impactful moments in this entire movie is the moment where, so he takes Joy and he, so in order to not be able to be tracked, he downloads her into a thumb drive and takes her with him. And now her entire memory exists only in this thumb drive. It's not like in the cloud anymore, although they don't use that word. And then when he gets captured in Vegas, Love, his nemesis, destroys this thing, killing Joy. And that moment, that last little moment where she's about to say, I love you to him, and then she stomps on the thumb drive, I think was just, it's just so beautifully executed. Like it's an obvious thing in some ways, but it's just the execution of it and his reaction to it and her, that momentary fear that she has of like, oh no, I'm going to die. Like that is, again, is this the central question of the original movie.
That's
right?
The nugget of the original story and both great films, which is if an artificial being is told you're going to be shut down forever in 30 seconds, why wouldn't that entity be afraid?
Right. And does that alone make somebody human?
If you give it the ability to enjoy something or to appreciate life or to see beauty, then you've already created something. Like we're not just watching a scene of a hologram being snuffed out in front of a fancy android.
Right.
These are all creations with human emotions, created right. by humans with remnants of real love, hate, passion, sadness, right. loss.
The last, I guess, little bit to talk about is who does eventually turn out to be Deckard's child. And if you have not seen the movie yet, I don't know why you would have listened this long, but you might want to, you know, skip ahead or turn it off and go watch the movie, which you should anyway. But it turns out to be...
This woman has, what, two scenes, and she breaks my heart.
She is
wonderful in this movie.
Fantastic. She is stunning in this movie. No, she is, her performance, just like you said, she has two scenes. She has, you know, a handful of lines.
Kay comes to, she's basically a genetic memory, like super genius. Like she's the one who can implant memories, create memories.
She creates the memories and implants them in the replicants so that they feel like they had a life.
Right. So as part of his investigation, which by the way is very much like a film noir, A to B to C, you know, much like the first film, but it is, you know, a lot bigger. It's more expansive. Yeah. Obviously, it goes to other cities even, for Christ's sake. But in the course of his journey, he has to investigate this memory expert, and she looks at the memory that he's dealing with, and we don't see it in full. We just see her watching it. And that sequence is Oscar-level great.
Well, what's amazing about it, that, you know, watching it, this is my third or fourth time watching the movie. Obviously, when you're watching the movie the first time, you're not supposed to pick up on this, but it was one of those things where you're like, you watch it, and once you know what the truth of the movie is, you're like, oh, how did I miss that? Because she cries like nobody's business, which, when she sees this memory, she says, you know, we put pieces of ourselves into every, you know, every memory that we create at one point. And then she also tells him, she says, no, this is real. And he takes that to mean that it's his real memory.
Right. And that's not the case.
Right.
All she is saying is the memory is authentic, not that it belongs to you.
She knows that it's authentic because it was her memory.
Right. And I just looked it up because I wanted to get it right. That is Dr. Anna Staline, as played by Carla Jury, J-U-R-I. And she's wonderful.
Yeah.
That is just a great piece of acting. And in, I think, literally two semi-long sequences.
You feel so much for her in just that tiny little bit. Like, just, you know, and because partly I think, again, partly I think this is writing. I think it's the writing in combination with the performance, because I think that the writing and the visuals, so the conceit here is that she has some sort of autoimmune disorder or some sort of immune disorder. So she can't interact with people. She's behind glass. And, you know, she has been given this digital playground to play around in, or digital sandbox, where she gets to create, look at memories and then create memories. And she lives in this sort of world where she can kind of make holograms of whatever it is she wants to, but she can't interact with people. And
you know what I always thought, Stephen? She seems to me to be like Villeneuve said, hey, this character of Tyrell's niece that we keep hearing about, I'm going to like create a character who is exactly like that, because that kind of is the role she plays, is the, you know, the memory extrapolator and provider.
Right. And which is ironic. And again, I don't think accidental that it is that she is Rachel's daughter, that Rachel was able to birth this thing that now has the experience that Rachel thought that she had, but didn't.
Yeah. Yep. It's an echo of an echo kind of thing.
Yeah. Those scenes are fantastic. And, you know.
and why people love movies like this? Because they don't like drum it into your head like, oh, he just left this building. What he learned was A, B, C, D. Right. Like, you got to pick it up or you're not going to get it. That's all. Yeah. You got to piece it together like a puzzle. Yeah. And it's all there. But it's not in a lot of movies. He'd get back in the car and go, here's what I just learned.
Right.
A, B, C, D, E. And we'd go, okay, now we're all up to speed. What's the next spot on the adventure?
I mean, which might be why this movie didn't, you know, similar to its predecessor, did not do very well with general audiences.
Yeah.
You know, that people wanted to be more spoon-fed stuff. I think this movie does a much better job, and it lays out its exposition and the understanding of the world a lot better than the original does. But I think it may have not done as well as it could have because people weren't ready for something that sort of cerebral.
Well, the first one was not a moneymaker either. And I think the simple issue is that, you know, sometimes a smart science fiction film like Alien, which is a smart movie, sure, or Inception, they're a very smart movie, will make money. And then sometimes a smart movie just doesn't. It just, people look at it and go, yeah, it looks a lot like homework or a lot like philosophy theorem. And that's not, I want action or I want drama, I want romance, right. I want funny. And I remember clear as day thinking when Blade Runner 2 came out and didn't do well opening weekend, I thought, A, that's too bad. I was obviously hoping it did well. But B, not really surprised. That, you know, that didn't shock me.
Yeah.
But it also doesn't surprise me that it has quickly become one of the most discussed and beloved sci-fi movies of the last 10 years. And, you know, that's the last 10 years that's included some damn good sci-fi movies.
Yeah, yeah.
So
let's, I have two more quick scientific things.
Yep. All you.
The sequence in the Vegas lounge, which I think is one of the best sequences I've seen in any movie ever.
Where he is struggling with Deckard.
You know, he ends up in a lounge in Vegas, a performance lounge that, you know, at some point in the past was obviously used projected holographic entertainment. So Elvis appears and, you know, there's a big
Sinatra
dancing show. Sinatra is in the later.
Oh, bit, right. Yes. In the little machine. Yeah. Right.
So it was like, okay, this is clearly the Blade Runner past our future version of what happens in Vegas lounges now, only instead of it being actual Elvis, it's digital hologram Elvis that comes and performs. But this is now 30 years since this has been abandoned. and it's all glitching all over the place. And so the holograms will randomly appear. There'll be like a loud burst of sound for a second, and then it'll get suddenly quiet again. There's lights flashing all over the place. It's really disorienting. He doesn't know where Deckard is. I found that whole sequence just amazing and like visceral and, you know, especially in the theater, disorienting in exactly the right way, because I felt as disoriented as he did.
I wouldn't call either movie an action film, but both, and especially the second one, but have some action sequences, be it chase or fight or brawl or whatever it is, that are fantastic.
That opening brawl with him and Bautista is like next level.
And it tells you a lot too. You don't even know that he's a replicant until the third time he cracks his head on the wall and you're like, yeah, okay, no human could survive that. So he's clearly a replicant.
Right.
And so it's a fun action scene, but it's also telling you things.
Yeah. So anyway, this from a scientific point of view, it's hard to imagine a computer failure that, you know, 30 years later, there's enough still intact that you could project a hologram of Elvis singing, you know, 3 seconds of a snippet of a song, but that it would just randomly jump around the way that it does.
But there's like a tiny bit of electricity left in the wires, like there's a little bit of water left in the pipes, and if you kick the pipe, the water, a little bit of water will pop out, you know?
Or you can kind of consider it like, you know, like if sometimes when your computer or your computer monitor or your television starts going on the fritz and like random blobs of things will appear.
Right. It'll show you, you'll see a quick ghost image of a video you watched an hour ago. Like,
Or you'll move your browser window and it'll like, you know, a series of clones of your browser window will appear in a trail as you drag it across the screen, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yep.
So that's what it's evoking. Again, not in any way hurts my enjoyment of the thing. It's hard to imagine a scientific reason for that actually happen the way that it does, but
is there a way for you and I to logically discuss the idea of human plus replicant breeding? I mean, either they're completely manufactured, in which case it doesn't make any sense at all. It would be like having sex with a toaster. You're not going to have little toasters. So it clearly implies that they are at least partially human, the clone theory. But then you also wonder, how is it possible?
Well, so I think you have to, I think it says this in the movie, but you have to remember that this wasn't just any replicant. This was Rachel. And Rachel was specifically created by Tyrell as a next-gen model, as somebody who could replace his niece, as a member of his family, basically. And so the idea is that he figured out a way to do this, that this was a deliberate thing that he did for Rachel specifically because he figured out how it is he was going to do it. So Tyrell knew this wasn't an accident. It wasn't a thing that, you know, it was like a toaster didn't just suddenly become, you know, sexually compatible with a human being. Like she was built as a toaster with a working womb, you know?
Dude, let's write a movie called Toaster Womb.
And Jared Leto even says, like, he figured it out. I can't figure it out. No matter how hard I try, I need to find her so that I can figure out, or at least I need to find her child so that I can, you know, reverse engineer how he managed to get a replicant to be able to replicate. Honestly, I think the most unrealistic thing about both of these movies is how flawlessly people are able to use voice commands with a computer.
Okay, go ahead.
Deckard does it, you know, in a scene in the first movie, and then it happens numerous times in the second movie where somebody's like, all right, zoom in, all right, move left, all right, go up, zoom back out, and you know, they're issuing instructions to a computer, either, you know, a drone or to a computer that's, you know, zooming in on a photograph in the original movie. I don't know if you've ever tried to use any sort of voice recognition software or digital assistant on your telephone. I have mine turned off because for the most part, you're like, Siri, tell me how to get Mexican food. And, you know, Siri's like, are you looking for a book about Mexican food? And you're like, no, no, no. I want to know where there's a restaurant. Restaurant. You want to rest for Tron? What? It's just like it's frustrating. And even in 2020, we have not figured out how to get a computer to reliably understand.
And connected to that, I also find that, you know, remember when 24 was red hot and all you would see is zoom in on that.
Enhance,
and tune left. Oh my God, it was the vice president. It's like they kind of do that in this. I'm like, photographs don't work that way.
I love that scene because you know, it's so futuristic for 1982 that he's just talking to this thing and is zooming in on the computer. But the thing that he's looking at it on basically looks like a CRT television VCR combo.
Yeah, and this is one for the hardcore nerds. If you listen to the sound design while he's working on that zoom in, zoom out machine, it's some of the sound design that's used from the first couple scenes of Alien.
Is it?
Yeah. There's some sound cues that are taken from Alien.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Are they implying that, like, this is the predecessor of Mother?
Oh, yeah. Dude, there's a rabbit hole that you can dig into that Alien and Blade Runner universes are definitely connected, that Wayland knows new Tyrell and all that kind of stuff. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's on the internet, man. Go find it.
Well, it must be true then.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely true. And since I did throw out a lot of love for the actors, it's important before we roll out, how great is Jared Leto in this? I mean, I could take him or leave him. Sometimes I love him, sometimes I'm meh. But in, like, not a lot of screen time, he is intensely intimidating in a way that Tyrell, who is creepy, but Wallace is eerie.
Yeah.
I really love this movie. I think I love Blade Runner a half star or maybe a star more, only because it's the one I've lived with for 30 years. But this is clearly a sequel that's made by someone who reveres and adores the original and also had some really cool ideas of his own, surrounded himself with a great team. And yeah, unfortunately, it didn't make a lot of money, but people are going to be enjoying 2049 until 2049.
So grades.
A. And I'm not doing science.
this is as close to an A+ as you can get.
Okay.
A+. I mean, you know, like I said, it's one of my favorite movies of the last 10 years. I don't think it's...
Is it better than Arrival?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Really?
I like it a lot better than Arrival. Yeah. So, yeah, it's an A+. I think we've established that as a valid grade in earlier episodes. And on scientific intelligence, I think, you know, it's a movie that it's almost irrelevant. I think that there was nothing in it that took me out of the movie from a scientific point of view. So I think it's a solid B+. Obviously, there are a few things. It might be an A-, but I'm going to knock it down half a letter grade for the whole voice recognition thing. But nothing egregious from a scientific point of view. And it's just such an entertaining movie from beginning to end that asks so many profound questions about what it means to be human, what it means to be a person, what it means to remember things, what it means to feel connected to somebody, that I think that it's a movie I could chew on over and over and over again and never get tired of. So
wonderful. Thank you for listening. If you want to support the show with a few bucks, you can go to patreon.com/ScottEWeinberg and support the show there. And as a special extra bonus, we have a brief interview with DVD producer and Blade Runner expert extraordinaire, Charles D. Lazarica. And that is on the feed. You can download that right now if you want to hear the differences between the various cuts and Charles's fascinating experiences with this great film. Thank you for tuning in. We will be back with something probably, let's do something a little sillier next time.
Sillier than Flash Gordon? See you guys later. Bye.